Hello.
Hello. Welcome back to Artsing About. I don't know how to project myself when I don't have the proper audio.
We just had a conversation of how we don't know how to do this.
How do we restart?
Anyway.
This is Georgie talking, because I'm conscious you're not going to be able to understand who's who without our amazing sound recording. And this is...
Sophie. Hello. We are speaking to you live from Washington Square Park in New York City, baby.
You ask, why are you in New York City? Well, the simple fact of the matter is that Sophie's moved here, and that's basically it. I've come to visit.
Yeah, and that is kind of... There's just been a lot happening, hasn't
there? Hence the absence.
And we are... Series 2 is still coming. It's quite hard to record a podcast when one person is no longer in the country. However, I will be back in the UK before you know it, and we will be recording Series 2. We're just having a couple of months before we do that.
But... because we didn't want to leave you waiting too long, we have actually got a really, really special treat. Something a bit different for Sophie and Georgie. We've actually got an interview with the most amazing, amazing man. He was so articulate and completely gone on our level.
Well, no, he wasn't on our level. He was far more intelligent.
He was He just got down. He just
completely on our level.
He just
met us where we are.
He just got on board with the absolute shenanigans.
He got the shenanigans of it. We should say that this is Dr. Matthew Morgan of the Turner House Museum. We had the pleasure of interviewing him. We got to ask him all of our Turner-inspired questions. And yeah, that's what we're giving you today.
So Season 2 will be coming. We just want you to enjoy this podcast in the meantime and go and visit the exhibition that Matthew talks about.
It opens on the 8th of July.
So you've got time. Now on to the better audio recording that, you know, Sandman Harry's been able to provide us with. But RIP, the podcast finances didn't extend to inviting Harry along with us, so
to New York, you mean?
To New York. So Harry's God knows where in the world, but Soph and I are living it up, eh?
Hey, we are. Enjoy, and we will see you very, very soon with Series 2.
Bye. Okay, so we are here.
Are we recording?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
No, we're recording. It's an organic start, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you want to introduce?
No, you go for it.
Okay, we've got not one, but two really exciting guests today.
We do.
From Turner's House Museum.
We have Dr. Matthew Morgan sat with us. We are very, very grateful to have you here today.
Thank you so much.
Delighted to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me, guys.
Giving up your Saturday.
Oh, well, and then we've also got Matthew's daughter, Coco, in the room.
Arguably more important.
Yeah, she's the voice of the future, guys.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any argument there. Certainly far more important.
And so Turner's House Museum, that's why we're here.
Yeah.
So... Matthew, do you want to tell us a little bit about who you are, where you've come from,
how you got involved with the house?
I've been involved with the house. So I am the museum director at Turner's House, and I am a huge fan of Turner and have been for a very long time.
Probably helps.
It really does help. It absolutely helps. And one of the things that makes me very excited to go to work and be at work is the thought that the house... was where Turner was. You know, I can be standing in a place that he stood. I am standing in a place that he stood.
Yeah.
And I know that that's probably not going to get many people out of bed in the morning, but yeah, I'm really excited about that. I find that's a real thrill to know that sort of one of my artistic heroes was genuinely there and lived there. I'm very excited, very pleased to be working at Turner's House. And I come from a background of art history, obviously, and museums. I've worked in museums for about the last 10 years. And then before that in the commercial art world. I'm committed, really, to trying to effectively get people as excited about art as I am. Good thing we're all here together then.
You should come on a podcast.
Yes, let's do a podcast. I have had such an enormous amount of pleasure out of art, all sorts of art, that I can't believe that other people can't get as much enjoyment out of it. And I don't think you need to know really anything to be moved by something that you see or hear or experience. It does help, but it's not essential.
Agreed.
But I think a lot of people feel a bit put off when they look at something and they don't know what it is. I used to work at the National Gallery, and people would say things to me like, what's it worth? And initially I thought, well, that's a stupid question. Who cares what it's worth? It's a beautiful thing. But actually, it's a very good question, because we live in a capitalist society and we're used to judging value entirely in terms of monetary value. So if I say it's worth 10 million or 100 million, people go, oh, I know. Yeah, okay, that's an important thing. And people, I think, need to be given permission to engage with something just themselves and to say, I don't like that. That's rubbish. That's just a bit shit. Can I say shit? I've said shit. I don't like that. Nobody likes everything. But because people don't feel relaxed in a lot of art places, they don't feel that they can say that, or they don't trust their judgment to say that. And I'm very keen that we get rid of all of that, and that we don't have that, and that people learn that they can connect in any way that they like to a work of art, and find what they enjoy, because they will enjoy it.
Yeah,
totally. I mean,
so refreshing to hear that.
Do you know
as well.
That it makes me think of there's a segment we sometimes do on our podcast called Unexpected Art and Unexpected Places, where we get anybody to basically send us a picture of something that they have seen out and about that they have found beauty in, or they think is what
tells
they were
something or...
to be what they, you know, what artistic is. And that really speaks to that, isn't it? You know, people engaging with art in the way that they want to engage with art, and not listening to what the critics say is good art, because actually, you know, what does that even mean? It's just there to be appreciated and enjoyed. And art is always, at the very least, provocative in some way, whether it's provocative of joy or, you know, anger or, oh, I hate that piece of art. What is it? It always sparks conversation. So,
yeah.
So going back to Turner slightly. Yes. So where is this house?
The house is in St. Margaret's, which is just near Richmond, not far from the Thames. Mm-hmm. And when Turner moved here, he bought the land in 1808, and when he moved here, it was the countryside, much more rural than it is now, anyway. Sort of somewhat suburban London. And it was a part of the world where, in the summer, if you lived in London, you moved out of London. No sewerage, horses, animals. It must have been pretty horrible, actually. Phenomenally horrible. And I sort of think, just as you read about people in New York leaving in the summer and going to the Hamptons, people moved to Richmond and around Richmond along the Thames out of London for a holiday place. And that's exactly what Turner did. So he bought the land. He was very successful as a young man, very financially successful as well as critically successful. And he bought this place as a holiday home to get away from it all. His main studio is in Marylebone, just Queen Anne Street, just near Harley Street. And that's where he had his studio and his gallery. He built a big gallery, would invite all his rich clients to come and have a look at the paintings, show them off there. And when he came here, he didn't do that. He just wanted to relax.
Well, it's the true him in a way, isn't it?
Well, that's, I think, I completely agree with that. And that's one of the things I think is really exciting about the house, is that it's a chance to see that side of himself that he didn't show, as it were, to the public.
Yes.
You go and you have a look at his paintings at the National Gallery, at Tate, and that's the showman. You don't really see the real person. He's a very private person. There's a lot about him that he doesn't really want, to let everybody in. And I totally get that too. So the house is not very big. It's, I think, quite sort of domestic and easy to grasp. He brought his dad with him. His dad lived in the house for most of the time he had the house. Dad worked in the garden, growing the vegetables, right now, perhaps by the time this podcast goes out, it won't be so topical, but right now I think growing your own vegetables
seems
to
be really important.
And Turner loved to fish. Throughout his life, he loved to fish. There's reports of him going out.
It's interesting because so much of his work is water, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. And light.
Yeah, and like, yeah. And yeah, I completely agree with that. That yeah, although very often the water is doing something that yeah, doesn't do on the Thames.
Yeah,
yeah, that's true. But yeah, he'd go out and he'd fish and come back, and there were two little ponds in the garden of the house. And in the days before refrigeration, what did you do with all the fish that you caught? You put them in the pond, and then when you wanted them again, you just hoiked them out and ate them.
God,
so that's exactly what he did.
Seriously, that's amazing.
Yeah, yeah, I know. It's so simple, hey? You know, who needs a refrigerator?
Yeah.
And so that's exactly what he did. And we don't really know why he had this rather, I don't think, very nice nickname for the local kids. They called him Black Birdie.
He called the kids that, or they called him that?
They called him okay. Black Birdie.
That's and interesting.
Maybe his clothes, we don't really know. Anyway, they clearly didn't like him because two of them snuck into the garden and put a pike in the pond, which then ate all the fish.
Oh, my God. So they were like, we don't like this guy, let's starve him.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Oh, my gosh. Do you feel that there's a difference? I mean, going back to what you were saying about him, this kind of being the real him. Mm. If presumably he painted whilst he was there. So do you feel as though there's a difference between the work that he painted whilst sort of there versus the work he painted sort of when he was kind of showman Turner? Is that...
I guess
you probably can't separate that because he would have presumably painted between both sort of locations, but...
It's an interesting question. We don't, at the moment, have any evidence that he painted in oils at Turner's house.
Okay.
Lots of... people have thought over the years that he might have done. And when the house was restored, they took samples of the floorboards. The floorboards are still genuine.
Wow.
And if you guys paint, you'll know, particularly in oils, that it's a messy old business.
Really messy.
And they couldn't find any traces of oil paint.
Oh,
but he's
wow.
Turner. He's addicted to drawing, addicted to making art. So I can't believe that he's not... walking around with their sketchbooks, maybe working on watercolours, working on prints while he's there. And really, you know, it's like sort of, you know, Friday comes, you turn the computer off,
yeah.
you walk out the office and then you come back on Monday. You know, he just wants to get away from it all. And one of the things that he doesn't do when he's here, which I think is quite telling, is he doesn't go round all of the other big houses in the area and... draw or paint them.
Mm-hmm.
And he's very commercially minded, Turner. He's not above knocking on your door and saying, you're rich, yeah, let me draw your house.
Yeah.
Or words to that effect. But he doesn't do that here. And I think he just wants to get away from it all. And he doesn't invite his clients here. We've got no evidence that he invited any of his rich clients.
So
friends, rich friends who were also clients, but not people who were just clients.
Right.
So he's turning off. And you know, for Turner, to kind of get back to what you were saying just now, you know, for Turner... the finished work of art is about, in some ways, it's about sort of the narrative, it's about the story, it's about sort of expression. And I find them intensely personal. You know, even some of the ones that are in these sort of mythological scenes, you know, sort of we have Ulysses and Polyphemus, and, you know, there is something intensely personal about the way he approaches them. But they're not exactly about him in the way that in the 21st century we think of something being autobiographical. They don't tell the story of Turner except through the emotions of Turner, at least not for me anyway.
So how did Turner get into art? How did he become an artist? How has he become the person that we sort of know and celebrate and love today?
He was kind of a child prodigy, really.
Right. Wow.
He was born and grew up in Covent Garden.
Mm.
His father was a barber, a wig maker.
Mm-hmm.
So successful, but now we might say because of working class.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
His mother sadly suffered from mental ill health. We can't really tell at this remove exactly what the problems were, except that she became unruly, I think was the word that they used to
unruly.
Such a degree that she went to hospital, went to bedlam.
And
there's two ways of looking at that. One, they just locked her away to forget about her. The other, that actually that was then the cutting edge of medical care.
Yeah.
So, you know...
That's hard for a young boy to live
very,
with.
Very, very hard.
Yeah.
But he, from a very young age, clearly was completely taken over by drawing, particularly.
Wow.
He, as a boy, was paid to colour in prints. And you've still got you can still see some of them in the library in Chiswick.
Okay.
So you have a book of prints, and somebody gave Turner some money to.
How old would he have been?
He was only, I don't know exactly, but I mean, sort of, you know, 10, 12, that sort of age.
Oh, I mean that really
young,
is like
very young. Yeah. And Turner's dad would put Turner's drawings in the windows of his shop in Covent Garden. And I live in hope that one day somebody's going to come along and say, oh, you know, I've got one of those early Turner works.
Tucked in a book somewhere. We've
discovered it, but unfortunately not. And what I think is amazing, I mean, brilliant, is, you know, we've, as you introduced, got Coco here, my daughter. So as a dad, you know, your daughter comes to you and sort of says, you know, I want to be a fine artist. Mm. A lot of people might say, yeah, that's great, but you know, why don't you think about maybe being a sort of graphic designer or, you know, something more practical. Turner's dad could easily have said that, you know, be an architect, you know, design silver, design furniture. Mm. Yeah, and there were lots of, you know, a burgeoning world in Britain at that time of luxury goods and people were making them. And Turner could have gone on and been a very successful designer in all sorts of things. But his dad doesn't say that. His dad says, yeah, you know what, Will, off you go, you know, be an artist.
Yeah.
And helped him enroll in lots of little, comparatively little academies for young artists. And then helped him when he was a student at the Royal Academy.
So he went to the Royal Academy. Okay.
Yes, yeah, he was one of the early students at the Royal Academy, and he remained devoted to the Royal Academy for the rest of his life. So, yeah, I mean, you know, we owe a lot to Turner's dad, old dad, as Turner called him.
It's really moving to hear that.
Yeah, and it also
makes you think of quite sad thought, really, like all those people who weren't encouraged.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, he is so... He is the poster boy for that movement, isn't he? Of that, like, kind of romantic British Impressionism type.
Yeah, I mean, do I want to be controversial? Yeah,
Be controversial.
I don't like describing him as a romantic because I just don't think that's him. I mean, he's melodramatic, he's dramatic, he loves the sublime, he loves the terrifying. There's nothing sort of, I don't think, romantic about him. You know, he looks at the landscape and he falls in love with the landscape. But he also wants to tell you how real it is, how gritty it can be. He's not necessarily trying to make us fall in love with it. He's necessarily trying to make us actually sometimes be in awe of it.
Scared of it sometimes.
I mean, terrified. And while he, at the end of his life, starts to develop a much looser way of painting than he had previously as a young artist. You know, he's very precise, he's very accurate. You know, you feel that, you know, when he paints a street that you could go into that street and recognise it immediately. The end of his life, he's kind of got away from all of that and he's really painting about colour, he's really painting about emotion, taking a slightly similar technical approach to some of the Impressionists. But where he differs from the Impressionists, I mean, apart from dying before they get going, is that whereas the Impressionists are busy saying, this is what it's like for me in this bar or in front of this church or whatever. Yeah, this is my reaction to what I see. Turner isn't saying that. Turner's saying, this is what we must all feel when we look at that. So he's trying to pull us along or influence us into thinking what he's thinking. Whereas the Impressionists are saying, well, this is what I'm thinking, take it or leave it. Huge generalisation there. But
it's
incredibly
interesting.
Yeah. So he's a lot of those late works that we look at, the only reason that we see them is that they came into the National Collection after he died. Yeah, they went, lots of them never really meant to be seen, or we don't think they were meant to be seen anyway.
Why was that? They were just sort of his.
Yeah, so when he died, he had a very confused will. So if I can sort of take just an aside, if there are any would-be lawyers out there or people who are thinking about writing a will, write a will, get a lawyer. Don't try and do it yourself.
Right, noted.
My will.
Yeah, because that's what he did and he had all these codicils and they contradicted themselves and it was just a mess. And so to cut a long story short, his family contested the will and in the end, effectively, the family got the money and the nation got all the works of art that were in his house in London, in central London. And that included everything. And it's not really clear whether Turner ever intended that. So all of his sketchbooks, all of his works on paper, and all the oils. So he had been collecting, I suppose is the right word, his own paintings. Mm-hmm. I think with the intention that they would go to the nation. One of the things he wanted in the will was that the National Gallery would have a Turner wing, which is really ballsy. I mean, you know, I mean, at the time, you know, the National Gallery is full, I mean, it is now, but full of what was considered to be the greatest artists in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, we might now say the Western world, but the greatest artist. Mm. And Turner wants himself, not just one or two, a whole wing there by himself.
Himself.
And you think, wow, you know, you get over yourself, mate. You know, but that's what he wants.
Out.
That's exactly what he wants.
But
and
they discovered
that's what he does.
That in his will.
That's in his will, yeah.
So they
yeah.
were like, oh, God, it's so sad. Turner's gone. He wants one. What?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, my God. And yeah, and they're just inundated with literally tens of thousands of works of art by Turner. Most of them are drawings.
Oh, I never
And if
knew
anybody
that.
Is listening and is interested, go on the Tate website. They're all catalogued and you can see them all. And there's pages and pages of really fabulous drawings and sketches and things, but including lots of these oils, which now we look at and go, wow, you know, he's really sort of prescient. He's doing these things that later we would come to understand. And at the time, people didn't know what was going on. They looked at them, they literally thought they were rubbish and very nearly threw them away.
Such a common occurrence in art.
It happens
all the time.
And what we don't know still is, are we looking at things that he thought were finished, but he just didn't want to show them because he didn't think anyone would get them? Are they just steps on the way to somewhere else? Are they experiments that didn't work for him? We just don't know. But as you were saying, later on come the Impressionists, and then come the people painting abstract paintings, and you have abstract Expressionists, and oh my gosh, yeah, it looks like Rothko. That's just sort of, you know, mind-blowing. And we don't really know what that's kind of all about. But they are beautiful, beautiful things. And for me, the great thing about any great artist is that there's the possibility for each generation to reassess them.
Yeah.
You know, when you go to a Shakespeare play, you don't have to be an Elizabethan to like Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you don't have to be an Elizabethan to get something out of it. You know, Romeo and Juliet, they're in love. I've been in love. I understand that. That's timeless. That's amazing. Yeah. And people can keep on putting on Shakespeare plays and finding new things for each generation. And that, for me, is Turner as well. There are things in his paintings that each generation latches onto and go, yeah, that's speaking to me. And whether it is the more abstract things or whether it's the kind of earlier works or whatever it is, he's producing things at last. And even if he would not recognise the way that we think about them and think, oh, that's completely wrong, I didn't mean that. The fact that we can do that, that's great. I mean, for me, that's a really great work of art, that we can go to it with our own mentality, 21st century mentality, and go, wow, that's speaking to me. Hundreds of years later, I mean, how does any person do that? That's, you know, mind-blowing. I mean, my mind's blown.
Absolutely.
We did a Turner episode of, we surprise each other with things, and I brought you the story of the Red Boy, when he painted the Red Boy.
Yes.
And you were just shocked, because you didn't know it. And you were like, he did? What? Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah. And it's like, that happened 150 years ago, or whatever it is. Yeah.
Scandalous is gossip.
I know. I
want to go back to what you were saying, though, about Turner and sort of how we are now sort of reappreciating his work, or his, you know, his work sort of changes meaning. I mean, something that I feel is kind of an ongoing conversation is how old masters and work that, you know, is historic, how that can be brought into the modern day and how it can be appreciated, and is it still important? You know, why is it important that we continue to celebrate and study and appreciate artists like Turner?
I guess for me, the kind of core reason for anybody connecting to any work of art is that it is a way of generating emotion. Even if that emotion is, oh my God, I hate it, I never want to see it again. So when, say, Titian created Pick a Painting, you know, Bacchus and Ariadne.
Yeah.
He would never have thought, oh, you know, people are going to be required to know about my life, know how this painting connects to the thing I did before and the thing I did afterwards, worry about who bought it. It's a beautiful thing. That's a beautiful object. And yes, he would have expected people who saw it to know the story. So maybe we need some help in the 21st century. But we put a lot of weight on the history. I mean, as somebody who is an art historian, that's the two things together, obviously. You know, I think a lot about the history. But you don't need to.
No.
And they're not made with that in mind, perhaps as we get closer to the modern day, more artists are thinking about their legacy and, you know, trying to explain what they do. And it becomes, in some cases with some artists, virtually impossible to understand what they do without the explanation. Mm. But, you know, I think a lot of, you know, artists originally, they didn't think that way. Mm. And we often think that there must be something really important that we don't know.
Yeah.
And you can just look at something and love it. And who cares who it's by? You know, I mean, is it by Titian? Is it not by Titian? Is it by one of his friends? Is it by his mum? Is it by his cleaning lady? Who cares? Mm. You know, if it's a beautiful thing, it's a beautiful thing. So I think that's why we should be looking at old stuff, however we define old. And we can then, if we really like it, go from there to finding out more.
Yeah.
I used to work with somebody who used to say, you know, that there's nothing you don't like, only things you don't know about.
Right.
And that's not true. There's lots of stuff I know about and I still don't like. John Constable, stand up.
But, I was thinking, when's going to be good? I was going to be like, what do you think of Constable?
Grenade.
He's a very interesting person, Constable. Mm. I think I might have liked him if I'd met him.
Yeah.
His cloud sketches are gorgeous. They are absolutely some of the most beautiful things ever committed to paper. He used to lie on his back in Hampstead Heath, painting the sky.
Mm.
Sketching the sky. And they're gorgeous. They're lovely. He produced a number of, I think also absolutely sort of heart-meltingly wonderful little landscapes, particularly of trees, which are just beautiful, beautiful, beautiful things. His six-footers, on the other hand, left absolutely cold. They mean nothing to me.
Hay Wain,
all those sort of things. People love the Hay Wain, and that's fine. You know, nobody has to follow. You know, like what I like. It just doesn't float my boat. That's okay. And just as a bit of a joke, I always sort of say, oh, you're either Team Turner or Team Constable. But actually, in the real world, that's pretty true. You know, some people can like both of them, not many in my experience.
Yeah.
But that's okay, you know.
We did an episode, or Sophie did the Red Boy episode. We spoke about, for the listeners who don't know who Constable is, Constable and Turner were sort of rivals, and that's sort of the very different worlds.
Yes.
Emerging at the same time.
Both painted landscapes in a very different way.
Although, to be fair, everybody was a rival to Turner. I mean, he was super, super, super competitive.
So on that note, actually, one of our questions was, he was a bit of a notorious character. He got up to sort of, he was pretty contentious. Have you got any kind of good stories about...
Or fun facts.
Fun facts about Turner's sort of notoriety? And
So as a young man, as a kind of aspiring artist, he was much more conventional. And he spent quite a lot of time building, I suppose now we'd say building a client base, you know, getting to know wealthy people who bought art, and becoming friends with influential people in the art world, other artists and critics and stuff. And, you know, that's, you know, people do that in all sorts of industries. So there's nothing sort of strange about that. Mm. Later in life, in the sort of 1830s, really, he was really quite rich for an artist.
Mm.
And he just got to a point, I don't think, where he really needed to do that anymore. You know, people were buying his paintings. You know, he didn't really need to schmooze people he didn't like. And he wasn't desperate to sell things. And I mentioned earlier on about his studio and all of the works of art there that went to the nation. Yeah, he was buying his own paintings back.
Really?
To have in his house so that when he died, they'd go to this big sort of, you know, art thing of his. So, you know, he's rich enough to produce pictures and then either not sell them or buy them back.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's got money in the bank. And he just gets to point, I just don't think he gives a damn. You know, and so there's lots of stories of, you know, him sort of behaving badly. There's sort of people coming up to him in the street and saying, are you Mr. Turner? And he came, no.
Really?
Yeah. And, you know, people were scandalised by that. And now you think, well, you know, if you go up to George Clooney and start hassling him and, you know, he might not like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's not so crazy. And I think in some ways he just kind of lent into it. You know, there's a sort of feeling, and if you've seen the Mr. Turner film, yeah, there is this sort of portrayal of Turner as a sort of an irascible, kind of grumpy, you know.
You're just describing Sophie there, really.
Yeah, I know. It's making me think of my favourite poem. You know that poem that's like, when I'm old, I shall wear purple with a red hat that doesn't go And I do you not know this poem?
Do you know this poem?
So, no, keep going.
That sounds wonderful. I want to know.
It's like my favourite poem. It's called, it's all about like basically like, it's all about like when you get older, you just don't, as you say, like you just don't give a damn. Yeah. And there's like a line that's like, and only eat sausages for tea. And it's like, it's a really, really,
it's brilliant. It's a wonderful
We'll
book.
Put it on the Instagram.
Yeah,
or
yeah,
it reminds me of how you just don't care.
He just doesn't care. And, you know, we get, I think, so used to thinking about art through the lens of the biography of the person who's producing it, that, you know, all of these kind of stories about Turner being bad, they sort of feed into this narrative that's being created later in life. And he's a kind of out of time, out of kilter. You know, it's in the middle of the kind of Victorian era, or the beginning rather of the Victorian era, and he dies in 1851. And he just doesn't fit in. It's a bit like meeting a sort of unreconstructed 60s man.
Right.
You know, he comes from a sort of a period
time.
Where, yeah, certain types of behaviour are, if not acceptable, certainly kind of in the mainstream. Mm. And loads of people meet him and they're shocked and appalled. He's got terrible manners. You know, he speaks with this working class accent. He's often described as a Cockney. And that's all part of sort of saying, oh my gosh, he's not one of us.
This kind of suave gentleman.
No.
Yeah.
And when you think about him compared to, say, the Pre-Raphaelites, who are the kind of the young people coming up as he's an old man, they're all middle and upper class. Yeah, they're all quite sort of well turned out. Turner's from a period where most artists can come from more working class, more sort of humdrum backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And that's what he's like. And he's just rich enough to just not care. Somebody said to me, is he a bit like Alan Sugar? I go, yeah, he's a bit like Alan Sugar.
Ooh, that's interesting.
He's like, yeah, this is my accent. I've got the money. Stuff you. You know, if you don't like it, you know where you can go.
He's making me think of Lewis Capaldi, but not like that. Not that Lewis Capaldi is irascible and whatever. I'm just thinking that it's the juxtaposition between the sort of the beautiful kind of romantic sort of
and then
as a figure, he is so sort of in so many ways just a complete juxtaposition of the sound that comes from his mouth. Like Turner creates, but maybe it's not such a juxtaposition. You know, the work that Turner creates, to me at least, and I'm pretty sure this is a fairly universal opinion, is it's dramatic and tempestuous and perhaps he's slightly like that as a person. So maybe not so, just a bit of a grumpy old man.
Just a grumpy old man.
What, I mean, God, this is probably a really, really difficult question to ask you. You know what I'm about to ask. What is your favourite Turner painting, or what's the one that you always kind of veer towards?
I mean, the one that I keep on coming back to again and again and again is Rain, Steam and Speed, which is at the National Gallery.
I love that one.
Which
I made a mental bet with myself that you were going to say that one.
I know. But there are so many. I mean, you know, again, here we are in Twickenham. It's a bit like saying, what's your favourite Beatles song?
I know.
You might have a favourite Beatles song, but that doesn't mean that, and so there's loads and loads and loads of others that I love. So there's I've been thinking quite a lot about paintings of volcanoes at the moment in various different ways for various different things. Turner painted a volcano. In fact, he painted two volcanoes, but one in oil and one in watercolour. And there's one up in Liverpool in the Victoria Gallery, the eruption of the Soufrière. And the Soufrière is an island in the Caribbean. And Turner painted this volcano really on the basis of a description that he read in a pamphlet.
I was going to say, he never probably went to the Caribbean, did he?
No, he never left Europe. And yeah, so I've been thinking quite a lot about that. I mean, it's quite a remarkable painting in its way, connected to other paintings of volcanoes by other people. There's an absolutely kind of mind-blowing sea piece. We were talking about kind of sea pieces, which is in Portugal in the Gulbenkian Museum. Which is just, there was an exhibition, Turner and the Sea, at the National Maritime Museum a few years ago, and I was stood in front of this painting, and something hardly ever happens to me ever, that I was just sort of stood there and another guy stood next to me who never met, and we just got chatting about how just remarkable this painting was. I mean, it's just so full of action and just rolling waves and people in the sea and they're drowning. It's just amazing. I could go on. In July we're going to have an exhibition at Turner's house of works that he did when he went to Italy for the first time. Mm-hmm. So
God, that must have just been...
It blew his mind.
That repeatedly of these people who, what we have to remember as like 21st century people is that like you couldn't just Google it. You hear about Michelangelo, David, you couldn't just Google it. You'd hear this myth. There is... a marble statue 3 times the size of you, and it's the most beautiful thing you'll ever see in your life.
Yeah.
And you might not even see it. You might never be able to get there.
You just know that it's there.
Yeah. And yet all these people, we've been told about it, and then they go and they see it. I mean, part of me thinks there must have been a part of, like, is that... No, but they would have been. They would have been blown away.
They would have been blown away. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, there's a... in the, I think, 1920s, Henry Moore and Barbara Hepworth won a prize. I can't remember how much money it was, and they used it to go to Italy to do exactly what you, 100% exactly what you've just said. And yeah, even then, when they had photography, you know, without actually going, you know, you couldn't really kind of connect to some of these things. And yeah, so Turner goes to Italy, exactly that. And as well as seeing the things, he sees the light, and he is just blown away. I mean, he's fascinated by light, and he's seen lots of paintings, particularly by Claude Lorraine. He's a French artist who worked almost totally in Italy in the 17th century. And yeah, and he's just sort of, you know, transformed really for the rest of his life. And he comes back and starts painting English scenes as though, yeah, suddenly we're in the Mediterranean. You know, so we're going to have this I mean, quite beautiful watercolor of Hythe in Kent. Which you could just see Turner's going, we're not in Kent. We're actually sort of, you know, on the Amalfi Coast.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, you could sort of say if it crossed out Kent and wrote Amalfi, you go, yeah, I get that. And so, yeah, there's some good, beautiful, beautiful watercolours that he makes coming out of this trip.
So you really feel it when you see them. You really feel the change and the excitement. And
you could see the change. And yeah, I was saying this to somebody just yesterday. Yeah, it's like... well, there's two things going on. First of all, both of which I think we can all connect to. I mean, at least I hope we can. I suspect that a lot of people, if not most people, have had a experience where they've been somewhere and they think they know it, you know, from they've read it or they've seen it on TV or whatever, and they go, it's even better in real life. You know, like wow, you know, this is like sort of better than I expected it to be, and I thought I knew a lot about it, but actually just being there is even more impressive. And I think the other thing is, in my mind, it's like you've got your favourite album and you've heard it over and over and over again. And you go like, I know every note, I know everything about this. And then you see them live and you're like, wow, I didn't really know, you know, what this music could do.
Oh my gosh.
Didn't really know, you know, where it could go. That's just amazing. Yeah. And you think you know. And Turner thought he knew. He'd seen all these paintings. He thought he knew about this light in Italy. And then he goes, no. I mean, you just got to get the live experience. You've got to see it. You've got to be there. And it blows his mind. Mm. And he goes back again. And he then, in the sort of 1830s, produces these wonderful watercolours of Venice. And that's another story. But
that sounds amazing.
Yeah. So if anybody finds themselves in St. Margaret's in Richmond
from
July onwards, come to Turner's house.
Absolutely. Yeah, please.
Plug.
Yeah, absolutely. We're gonna,
please plug. I mean, yeah, we, you know, we'll be there at the very least, won't we, Soph?
Yeah, 100%.
Good to see you guys.
Yeah. It's such an amazing experience being in that house. And
so what do you guys know about Turner? Here am I kind of, you know, Turner.
Oh, my God.
You know, let's share.
Well, I mean, we're both local girls, aren't we?
Yeah, we are.
We're both local. So, you know, our appreciation of, we, you know, I've always known that Turner's house has been there. And I know that, you know, it was about 12, 13 years ago that the house was sort of redeveloped. Because I remember it being redeveloped and there being a huge sort of buzz and, you know, it was really exciting. And I came and visited it when it was very first opened. But my appreciation of it, you know, is really, you know, I know... just enough about Turner, you know, seen lots of his works of art. We studied Rain, Steam and Speed,
didn't we?
That was when Sophie and I, we both did History of Art together when we were at school. We both studied it for A-levels.
Yeah.
So actually what you were saying there about, you know, actually seeing, you think you know and then you see it, that's, you know, that's a real change. So actually we had that, didn't we, a lot, where you sit in a classroom studying a work of art, knowing every single thing there is to know about this work of art, and then we go on these class trips to see them at the museum.
Which we were lucky enough to do in the first place, you know.
Oh, like, completely, you know. Going on day trips, it was just, it was absolutely amazing. So Rain, Steam and Speed, I feel, was the first of Turner's paintings that I got to really, really enjoy and yeah. appreciate and love. And I feel like I have a very sort of surface memory of the details of it, but I know exactly in my head what it looks like. I just can't remember all the facts. But as you said, it doesn't necessarily matter. No, it doesn't really matter. You know, it's helpful to have a loose sort of understanding of the artist potentially all the time that they were painting. Mm-hmm. But actually, you can look at any of his works of art knowing loads about him or very little and always take something away from it, whether yeah. that is yeah. love definitely. Or hate or, you know, oh wow, I prefer Constable Turner's paintings to rubbish. Or
but also, like, on a really, really basic level, like, we have this ongoing joke on the pod about, like, how you don't like landscapes.
I really don't like landscapes.
Dear. But he makes landscape interesting. He makes landscape, yeah. like, it sounds a weird word to use, but like he makes landscape sexy. Mm. Like he makes it really like evocative and makes you feel things. Mm.
Turner's the exception to my resentment of landscape. I do like landscape. I find for me the things are not I find really interesting, and this is different to you, and I have no doubt it's different to you. I find the really the history side of the art mm-hmm. more interesting. Yeah. I find the stories about the artist, I find the stories about the techniques and the context in which it was painted, and therefore if there's a person in the painting, I find that really interesting because I like to know about that person. But then you're really interested in sort of the form as well, mm-hmm. which is not something that... And I do actually paint, so that's quite weird that I'm not as interested in the form. I just... Yeah, it's...
But it's interesting what you say about the history, because sorry, I'm this is going to take a moment, Harry. I'm really sorry, because I've got you know when you like have a thought and you're like, oh yeah, but how do I say it? Because yeah. like
for a drink of water, just yeah. to...
I'm not going around yeah. time for drink. No, but like you say the thing about the history, and you were talking about like the subconscious of what comes through the artist onto the canvas. In this case, like that we get it, we. As an audience get without knowing the history. Mm. And I'm just thinking about Rain, Steam and Speed. Mm-hmm. You know, when we studied it from the historical aspect, we're knowing that like the railway industry was like this massive booming thing at the time. And, you know, this was something really, really topical. Mm-hmm. Mm. And his use of like black and red. I remember we studied that. But you don't need to know the history in order to understand that like there's this big imposing you know train in this rural setting. I feel like I haven't explained myself but it's this thing of like the merging of the two, and it helps to know the history, but it's reassuring
to know that, you know, art is a lot more accessible than people necessarily realise it is. And like, you've done quite a lot of work yourself with sort of adult accessibility and art. Am I right in thinking?
Yeah, I mean, I've taught all sorts of different groups of adults and children. Mm. As somebody who also comes at it really from a sort of place of art history, it's tempting for me to put a lot of explanation in.
Right.
So you talk about Rain, Steam and Speed, and I go, oh, yeah. Da, 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 da. And that's great. You know, that interpretation is really helpful. But is it necessary?
Yeah.
You know, shouldn't the painting just speak for itself? Yeah. And sometimes with different groups of people, actually, the more stuff, it just takes away.
Yeah.
You know, maybe you don't do this, but, you know, you go to an art gallery and actually look at the label, and then you just kind of glance at the painting and you walk away. Mm-hmm. You go, oh, like, yeah, I know what I need to know. You don't know what you need to know, because the painting is giving you the clues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you should take 2 minutes, or even just a minute. I mean, try looking at a painting for a minute. Just take out, you know, your watch and or your phone and time yourself for a minute. It's quite difficult to just look for 1 minute at one thing. You know, we're looking for meaning.
Yeah.
And I'm the same myself. But sometimes before we get to the meaning, we should look at the form.
Yeah.
You know, is it a beautiful thing? Or is it an emotional thing? You know, it doesn't have to be beautiful. You know, is it kind of making my heart sing, making me cry, making me sad, even making me bored? I mean, what is making me bored about this? And, you know, Coco will have heard me say this, you know, plenty of times. You know, it's okay not to like something. Yeah. The tricky thing is to ask yourself why.
Yeah.
Why don't you like it?
Yeah, that's the next step that is the kind of complicated thing. It's like, why don't I like it? Because it's a landscape. It's a why don't I like landscapes? Because there are no people in them. Yeah. Why do I like people? What is it about? You know, that's the sort of next thing rather than just walking away.
It reminds me of that fact, isn't it? That something like only 7% of communication is the words we hear.
I also think that's really interesting, and I'm also waving my hands a bit. Yeah, so when you look at a portrait, and I'm interested in portraits as well, although Tennyson's not a portrait painter, you see largely, often, somebody posing.
Mm.
And we think that we get that physicality and we understand what those things mean. But actually, even the gestures that we use, the meanings have changed over centuries.
Yeah.
So much of our communication is our hands, is all these movements.
Yeah.
And yet everything is so static in a painting, because it has to be. Yeah. You know.
Well, we as human beings, we want to put people in boxes. It's so funny because that's how our brains work. My mum always taught me this from a young age, like, don't put people in boxes, because that's what the brain wants to go, okay, well, you're this person, you're that person, that's your role in my life. And actually, we're so much messier and knottier than that. Mm. And I think that's a really interesting thing, because it makes me think of, you know, the first time I can't remember the first time I walked into an art gallery, but I wonder what's changed as I've grown up about how I've...
Your impressions of the world.
Yeah. That is interesting. I think that's really fascinating. When you look at a portrait and you see somebody's face and you think, oh, well, I know something about them because I can see, you know, you're just putting them in boxes.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think what you've just said is really fascinating, that maybe those boxes change as time goes on. And when you look at that painting later, I thought you were this sort of person, but no, actually, maybe you're this sort of person.
Yeah.
And the painting's not changed. It's you that is changing.
Mm.
Yeah, does that make sense?
No, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I wonder if that's why the Mona Lisa is still subject to such a sort of a subject of conversation, is because she is so, to me at least, undefinable, and to so many other people, undefined. You know, what box does she fit in? This is really uncomfortable. What is she doing? What does her face mean? I don't understand. I wonder if that is why she is so sort of loved, uncomfortable, because people don't know how to define her. They don't know what bracket to put her in.
That's so true.
Oh my gosh, we're going off on such a tangent, but this is fascinating.
Other than, because I'm going to do that. I'm going to go to an art gallery and I'm going to try and look at something for 1 minute.
Yeah,
it's going to be a struggle.
The other thing, I've started doing this, is we generally fool ourselves, I think, that we are good at telling what people are like from what they're like on the outside.
Yeah.
Oh. You say putting people in boxes. And just as a fun thing to do, if you've got moments that you're not looking at a phone, have a look at a portrait of somebody that we don't know who they are. You know, unknown man, unknown woman, whoever it is. And just think about what kind of a person they were.
Mm-hmm.
What can we tell when we have only the clues of our eyes?
Yeah.
You know, we don't know their history. We don't anything. And your guess is as good as anybody else's. I mean, none of us know.
Yeah.
But I think that's a really kind of intriguing way to connect to pictures of people.
Yeah.
Because the clues, to get back to what we were saying, you've got to look.
Yeah.
The clues in the painting, there's nothing else.
Yeah. And it will actually tell you a lot about yourself as well.
Yes.
The decisions you make of who that person is.
Mm. Yes, I like that. It's so right.
But cracking one, so that's great.
Well, maybe go together.
Yeah.
And then compare notes.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, how's we should that? Do it, and then we should come back and record an episode about what we discovered.
Yeah. Yeah.
We could tell each other.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
National Portrait Gallery is going to open sometime this year, I think.
Yeah, that's your favourite gallery.
Now's your chance.
Love the National Portrait Gallery. Yeah.
So other than these challenges you've put to us, because we've said this to you, we're all about trying to make art accessible to all, and for people who feel like museums and art galleries and this world is just something not for them. It's got people that, it's just, they've been told in a variety of different ways, no.
Yes.
What would you say is your biggest piece of advice to get people to realise that it is for everyone and that there is something for them there?
Mm.
We're very lucky in the UK that lots of art galleries are free. Yeah. Sadly, Turner's House is not free, but other places are free. So there's nothing, that barrier to entry might not exist for lots of people. You've got to get there, sure. But once you're there, it need not cost you anything to go in to lots of places. You can go to Tate. If you're in London, you go to Tate. If you're in Manchester, you go to Manchester Art Gallery. You can go to lots of places. And look at one thing, just one thing.
Mm.
And pick something, anything. Wander around and be prepared to find something that gives you pleasure. And nothing, also be prepared to walk out and go, they're all rubbish, I hate that. One of the things that I gives me pleasure, great pleasure, is being involved in museum things where people are laughing. I love the sound of people laughing in museums, in galleries. Because you know, somewhere in the back of our minds we go, well, we shouldn't be doing this. You know, laughter is a bit sort of frivolous and, you know, we should be serious and think about history. No, just find something that puts a smile on your face. Yeah there's a, I think it's a Twitter, is it an Instagram thing called Museum Bums.
And yeah.
And people just post photos of bums in paintings.
I've never heard of this. This sounds right.
It's great. It's great. And, you know, people just you know, once you start looking, yeah, you really, really notice they are everywhere. And I love that. I absolutely love that. It's irreverent. Yeah. It's fun. You know, we're all laughing. You know, why not?
Why not?
Why
exactly.
not?
It's funny.
No, but genuinely, like, if you actually
even
like.
Saying bum is quite funny. Yeah.
No, but in all seriousness, like why not? Yeah, why not laugh in a museum? Yeah, why not say I don't like? Because actually, by saying that, you know what? That did nothing for me.
Yeah.
Constable.
Yeah. yeah. No bums in Constable,
no,
I should say.
No. Yeah, definitely not. You know, you're giving yourself the autonomy to have an opinion and your opinion matter to you.
Yeah, completely.
And it's, you know, that's a really, really nice piece of advice to just laugh.
You don't have to go and see the Mona Lisa. You don't have to see anything that everybody tells you to see. You know, if you open up an art book and go, the top 10 things to see in the world. You don't have to like any of those. You don't have to see any of those. Yeah, you can pick something obscure or small. You can like the colours of it. Mm. You can like the shapes of it. The lots of different ways of engaging with things. Mm. And, it's in some ways, we already do this. You hear a song and there's some thing about that song, something you can't define. You go, I really like that.
Yeah.
And it could be any kind of, type of music, any genre, any period, you go like that really kind of got my toe tapping kind of thing, whatever it is. You can't say why. Is it the chorus? Is it the lyrics? Is it the drum beat? I don't know. And I don't know why I like that any more than I like that. It doesn't make you like that song any less, even though you can't describe why. And I think kind of looking at paintings should be the same. You should be able to go, I don't know why I like that, I just do. And that's enough.
Yeah.
So, what more do I need to say that, it's not Constable, I love it. Sorry, Constable lovers.
No, it's all tongue in cheek. It's all from a place of love. It's interesting. My mum went to the Winslow Homer exhibition before we did.
Yeah.
And she said it was brilliant. And forgive me, listeners, because I will have said this before. Like, I had just been, I'm not going to say what the exhibition was, but I'd just been to an exhibition where I left, like, my blood boiling. It was just so badly done. Like, I was just so annoyed. And I think it's probably because, we'd been working on this podcast and we've been working so hard at making it enjoyable and accessible to people. And I just felt like it was the complete opposite. I was like, this is not, like...
Yeah.
And... So I was a bit sort of like, oh, we've got this Windsor Homer. Like, okay, right, okay. And my mum went, she came back. And she is quite an enthusiastic person anyway. Like, every film's her favourite film. But she was like, it's the best exhibition I've ever been to. And I was like, oh, I'm going to not like it even more. And it was so good.
It was brilliant.
And she said, her and her friend who she went with, she said, we each picked our favourite painting. You've got to, once you've gone, come back and tell me which one your favourite painting is. And then I'll tell you which mine was. And we picked the same painting.
Wow.
And it wasn't like a famous one. It wasn't like anything. Mm. It was...
seascape.
It was a seascape.
Winslow Homer, seascape.
Yeah, it was a Homer seascape. And it was like in the last room. I remember looking... I think it was his last ever painting he ever did. So it wasn't a particularly well-known one of his. And it was both of our favourite paintings.
Interesting.
Isn't
and
that weird?
I like the cotton pickers.
Yeah, you like...
Which was the people.
Yeah.
But it, it
it's
is.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Completely. What's your favourite painting, Coco? Do you have one?
My favourite painting is the whistle jacket, the horse.
Oh, yeah. The great, the massive one that's in the National.
National Gallery.
Yeah.
Oh,
why,
amazing.
Why do you like that one so much?
All right, Georgie, take it.
No. I just think that's a really unusual one. I've just not heard
the judgment dripping on your voice.
I always remember going to the National Gallery with you when I was younger, and it just feeling like it's massive.
So it is huge.
Being huge. Yeah. And I saw it the other day, and I was like, oh, it's not as big as I thought it was.
Yeah.
But I also just love the fact that we don't know what was supposed to be there, and it's just this beautiful horse on a painting, and you can think it was anything. You could say someone was on it. It was anywhere you want it to be.
Yeah.
It's that.
Wow, that of all like the paintings you love, I think that's a pretty cool one to be like, that's my favourite painting.
Aren't there some Turners in the same room as that though? Yeah, like, so I bet you were like, there's some Turners over here. Yeah. Do you not like these ones?
Yeah.
It's okay to like Whistlejacket. George Stubbs was quite a good painter too.
You see through gritted teeth.
I know, I was thinking that. We'll
have words it
is,
later.
It is a fantastic painting, and but that's a portrait.
Yeah.
See, I always think that's a portrait. Yeah, it's a portrait of a horse, but it is a portrait. And when you look, when I look at him, and you know, I say this as somebody who's born and raised in a city. I know nothing about horses. In fact, they slightly frighten me, if I'm really honest. They're big and they've got minds of their own. I mean, you know, just get in the car. You know,
car.
Yeah, you know, bicycle. Officers. Bicycle if
you
actually have to.
Off on that horse.
Yeah, yeah, put it away. lost my train of thought. But yeah, you look in his eyes and he's got character. He's got, I can't read a horse's character, but you can see that he's a real creature. Yeah. To me, anyway, he feels like a real creature. He's not just a sort of, you know, a pantomime horse sort of thing.
Two-dimensional thing on a piece of paper.
Who are your favourite artists or paintings other than Turner or outside of Turner?
Very broad range. I like, sort of older than Turner, I'm a big fan of Rubens.
Oh,
nobody else is a big fan of Rubens.
I love Rubens.
Man knew how to use colour and shape and form. He did those portraits of all sorts of people, but he also painted these huge Baroque, sort of mythological scenes. Mm. He's sort of painter of the intellect as well. So, yeah, into Rubens, going in the other direction. I was really, I'm still really into an artist called Sophie Kai, who's a sort of conceptual artist, French conceptual artist. Mm. And she does sort of, I think, rather wonderful things. So she got a job as a chambermaid in a hotel in Venice. Mm. And while she was there, took photographs of people's luggage while they were out, and then use that as sort of the basis of her art.
Oh, my goodness.
And she does these sort of, you know, rather kind of wonderful, like I say, sort of conceptual pieces. And so she famously, controversially allegedly found an address book on the street, and rather than phone the owner of the address book, phoned the people in the address book to try and get a... Like a description, a picture of the person who owned it. And then the artwork is the transcriptions of the conversations that she has with people.
Oh,
so they're all these kind of, you know, really rather wonderful things. They're not visual in the sense that we've been talking about. They're much more conceptual, much more sort of, you know, about ideas, but they are, I think, rather wonderful. So, yeah, I mean, what else do I like?
One of the things we have a corner, we call it Sweet Art of the Week, where we will talk about a slightly lesser known artist, mm-hmm. or someone that doesn't necessarily have such a big platform. Is there anyone on your radar that is slightly lesser known that you know, you're really, really fascinated by or really want to support?
In terms of sort of older artists, I mean, slightly older than Turner, there's an artist called Johann Zoffany, who was a German artist, and he came and worked in England, London, and he largely is a portrait painter, almost exclusively really as a portrait painter, but he's got this incredibly precise style. Mm. You really feel that the people he's painting are coming out of the canvas at you. And he's a slightly like one of these sort of Zelig-like characters that, because he paints such a wide range of people, the things that he does connect into all sorts of ideas of the 18th century, so ideas of the Enlightenment, ideas of the Grand Tour. He paints monarchy, he paints abolitionists, mm-hmm. and he's a very kind of a clubbable person, so he joins all these things like the Hellfire Club, and he becomes a Freemason and all these sort of things. And he's also lots of sort of really rather kind of crude humour, which he loves. So he painted a self-portrait, and in the background there's a sort of condom tacked on the side of the wall.
Nice.
Then condom.
I was going to say, did they have condoms back then?
Yes, they did. Yeah. So also tacked on the wall is a reproduction of Venus d'Urbino by Titian.
Oh,
so
yeah,
he's obviously because of the sex.
You know.
Zoffany's very cool. I like Zoffany. Who sort of in a more kind of contemporaneous vein? Last year, I was thinking a lot about Kehinde Wiley, and you were talking about obviously Winslow Homer, and so Kehinde Wiley is an American artist, And probably his most famous work of art is of Obama.
Okay.
And he does very often paintings with sort of elaborate backgrounds that look a bit like...
The Obama one is where he's got a background of leaves.
Yes.
Yes, and there was one of Michelle Obama.
He didn't do Michelle, but he did Barack. One of the things that he does is he's very interested in the position of black people in Western art.
Yes.
And so he has produced a lot of works of... black sitters in poses from well-known old paintings. So the one that I'm thinking of is he's got a painting of somebody on a horse, and the original painting is by David of Napoleon.
Mm-hmm.
And the figure on the horse is a guy sort of dressed in sort of contemporary clothes. And the one of the many ideas, one of the ideas is that, you know, we've become so used to sitters in portraits in Europe being white that we sort of have forgotten that actually society then and now is much more sort of fluid and changeable, and lots more different people. And what does it mean to say, well, we're not going to have this emperor, but actually we're going to have sort of somebody who Wiley meets people on the street and asks them to if they want to take part.
Mm.
So, yeah, they're not like professional sitters, and they're not like famous people. They're just people that he likes the look of.
People like to look
And he's... Wiley is gay, and so there's also lots of elements in his works about how we think about gender, how we portray gender, and particularly masculinities. So I think he's really fascinating. One of the people that have influenced him is Winslow Homer. Particularly sort of seascapes.
Yeah.
And so what's another element of Gindy Wiley is he sort of be thinking a lot about the sea and people on the sea, and specifically migrants, how the sea has a particular meaning for the black diaspora, not a happy meaning. And so sort of the sea sort of comes in at various sort of points and sort of thinking about the movements of people, effectively.
It's just fascinating and important
work.
Honestly,
yeah. I don't know how long we've been talking for. Harry, how long have we been talking for?
1 hour and 11 minutes.
Oh, my gosh.
You see Coco's going, God, it's only an hour. Great.
It's absolutely flown by.
I know. But it's really interesting hearing you talk about that, because it's important work and it's important conversations to have, and it's all about bringing the message from, like, to the present day and making it, you know... I think art history can sometimes be seen, unfortunately, because of the name art history, as something that you look back on, but it's much as it's so relevant to art today and the important conversations that need to happen.
Oh, absolutely. And yeah, but the great thing about history is there's no answer. I mean, you know, we're constantly thinking differently about how we think about the past. And that's the same about art is, you know, if there was an answer to Rain, Steam and Speed, we'd get bored with it.
Well, it's not a maths question. It's not a maths equation for a reason, you know. Like, final question, because we should probably wrap up now, because you've probably talked to
something far better to do.
No. I'm thinking, we've taken up your time. But what are the future plans? What are your future aims and plans for Turner's House, then? What's your five-year plan?
What's my five-year plan?
Job interview.
In 5 minutes, I want everybody listening to at least think about coming to Turner's House.
Yeah.
And it would give me immense joy if... even some of the people listening did come to Turner's House. If you do come to the house, tell me or one of my colleagues that you came because of this podcast, and that would make us very happy indeed.
Aww.
So that would be good. More people to come, more people to engage with Turner.
Absolutely.
And my, I suppose, long-term goal is, as I was saying earlier on, the house was somewhere that he invited his friends, and there's something very special about that. And I would like... ultimately, people who come to the house to feel that they are getting that behind-the-scenes feel about Turner the man. Mm. You know, something special and something that not everybody gets.
Yeah.
You know, everybody can stand in front of Rain, Steam and Speed. If you come to Turner's house, you're seeing something about Turner that isn't immediately obvious in the National Gallery, for instance. And yeah, I'd like people to come to the house, relax, enjoy it, and laugh if they can.
What a great answer. What a way to end.
Oh, my goodness.
I feel like there's so much more. Like, we'll have to get you back because, like, I feel like this is like part one. Like, there's so much more to talk about.
Can we do a part two?
I know. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
A huge
honestly,
pleasure. I mean,
Matthew,
you know,
and Coco.
I can talk until, you know, cows come home, about art anyway.
And please keep talking. it's brilliant. It's so, yeah, rich and fascinating.
Next time I'll bring some squeaky jazz records in and everybody can be happy.
We realised just before we started recording that there's a mutual love between Harry and Matthew about jazz. You both love jazz.
Yes.
We didn't get an opportunity to talk about that.
It's a very broad church jazz. Lots of different types of jazz. So
jazz full stop.
Did I say you like painting? Yes, yeah, but yeah. What kinds of painting?
Until I don't listen to jazz, I hear jazz and I think, well, same thing. You must speak about this.
I don't know, but I mean, yeah, my poor family, they can just about live with the art. It's the jazz that is
the jazz is far less noisy.
The art is far less noisy.
In my room, and he'll think there's no one home, and he'll put on like the worst jazz I've ever heard. Yeah. One time I walked in and I said, "Dad, what are you doing?" He's like, "Oh, I just got a new Czechoslovakian poetry jazz record."
Oh, no.
Like, you don't speak Czech. Yeah, but the jazz is so good.
I'm sensing a lot of frustration sort of coming out, Coco.
Bagpipe jazz.
Bagpipe jazz.
Yeah, I mean, that is in some countries a form of torture.
I've also just noticed your socks, Coco.
They're little Frida Kahlo.
Frida Kahlo socks. That. Should have spoken about this earlier. On that note, thank you so much. Thanks again.
So much.
Thank you.
You're so passionate, and the way you talk about things, you just like add another thing to my endless to-do list of things I want to do.
Yeah.
Don't hang around. All of you, get up out of your seats. Right now, go look at some art.
Yeah,
it is literally all around us. I promise you, wherever you are, won't be very far away. You'll find something. Or if you're really, really, really stuck, there's the internet.
Or even better, there's Turner's House Museum in July when you've got the exhibition.
Yes. Yeah, come to Turner's House Museum. Did I say that? Come to Turner's House Museum.
Yeah.
Again, come to Turner's House Museum. You can use those bits, just intersperse
just randomly. Oh, well, it's been an absolute pleasure. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. Thank you very much for having me. It's been a huge pleasure as well.
This has been Artsing About with Georgie Turner and Sophie Doyle. Sound and music by Harry Jones. If you would be interested in hearing where Sophie and I complete our research, please contact us via the email address in the description.